your feelings on that. You have a long experience history, you have a deep education, and you have expansive experience all over the world. What would you say is really concerning you about the way that ground penetrating radar is used or marketed today?
Yeah, you know what? This has, what I'm about to say, hasn't changed for 30 years. Every few years, somebody comes along with what they think is a new idea. And when you have something new, you go, wow, I'm going to really promote this because...
Hi, this is Arian.
And I'm Forrest.
And welcome to Concrete Conversations, a construction podcast to help the average Joe be a little less meh. Who do we have here with us today, Forrest?
This is Jan Franke. Actually, at least I'm pretty sure that's how we pronounce your name. That's how I've always said your name. The first time that I saw it, I mean, I definitely said Jan Franke. Probably not the first time you've heard that, Jan. For starters, how do we say your name correctly?
You know, since you're American, let's go with that. You're right, it's Jan Franke. I think if you were Dutch or German, it would be a little bit more guttural and there'd be some spit coming out, but we'll go with the American translation.
Okay. Well, there was a little bit of spit that came out, but we're on video, so you couldn't tell. Yeah. Yeah. So, Jan, based on your name, I would say there's some sort of like Northern European influence here. Based on your skin tone, I would say there's no Northern European influence. Can you clear that up?
Yeah, so it's. I think it should be pretty obvious. I'm actually of Japanese heritage, which comes as a surprise to Japanese people. And it's really surprising. No, I'm kidding. I am Canadian. You know, that's how I identify myself. But I'm a product of colonialism. So I'm sort of half Dutch heritage and half Sri Lankan, actually. But I speak neither language, and hell, I don't even speak English, and was born and raised here in Canada, so I consider myself Canadian.
Cool. So you're like half Dutch, half Sri Lankan, and half Canadian.
That's good Californian math. That's right. Yeah. Yes, that's okay. Right.
Perfect. I just wanted to clear that up real quick. So, Jan, what do you do? You do ground penetrating radar. You do a couple of really interesting things in ground penetrating radar. We, Ari and I own a company. FYI.
Surprise.
So,
I don't know. You just, I guess it's a random call and you told me about this GPR thing. So I'm just making this up from here on in.
That's okay. We're all doing that. So, Arian and I own a company, Enhanced Scanning. We are a GPR service provider where we provide services with ground penetrating radar and other cool stuff. But you do something, about five, six, seven times more cooler, with GPR, which is what?
Well, it's actually about 7.3 on the coolness scale that the most recent time I looked.
You don't have to rub that in. Okay.
I'm kidding. You do. I'm sure you do some interesting stuff. So I've been working around, I'm a geophysicist, which is a really big term to say that I look at things in the ground, right? So the way I explain that to people is more like I'm kind of the radiologist, and I try to make the prettiest pictures possible to give to the doctors, who might be, in this case, the engineers, the guy with the backhoe operator, or a geologist, right? So I'm trying to make pretty pictures of the ground. And I specialize and have been for a really long time, like since the Reagan administration, I've been specializing in something called ground penetrating radar, which is what you know. And not just, you know, pushing a cart around and spray painting on the ground, but actually developing technology from the ground up and doing sort of custom radar systems and custom software. And I've had the opportunity to work in a large part of the planet. I've actually worked in over 100 countries now. And still travel every 2 weeks. I'm out to Africa or Indonesia or Brazil or wherever. So it's been a heck of a 30 plus years.
Oh, yeah. Can you take us back a minute and tell us what got you interested in GPR in the first place? What even turned you on to that?
And exactly what turned me on? Well, that's relevant. Thank God. So I came out of high school thinking I'm going to be a physicist because the girls would like that, right? Like that's all we're doing. We're guys and we're trying to attract girls. So physics, that's where it's at. And I go into first year physics, actually the first term of physics, and go, this is the stupidest subject ever. Who the heck is going to hire a physicist? Unless you work for a government lab, like, who hires a physicist, right? And I heard of this thing called geophysics. I'm like, oh, hold on now. Physics is all so theoretical, but geo, and they talk about stuff that's actually in the ground, so I can, like, imagine that. This is something I can actually see happening. So I thought, oh, I'm going to try this geophysics. And then I go into geophysics, and I go, wow, this is also pretty boring, because it's all about oil and gas exploration, because that's where the money is, right? And along comes this prof, and I am, well, let's face it, I'm enamored by her. I just think she's the coolest prof ever. You know, I'm probably 19 at the time. She's in her early 30s, whatever. And she was working with this new technology that was really new. This is late 80s, early 90s, called ground penetrating radar, right? And at the time, there were really only two companies producing GPR systems. The Americans, which was GSSI, and then our Canadian version, which is Sensors and Software. And we had, and actually it wasn't even called Sensors and Software, it was called A-Cubed at the time. And she had this, you know, one of the first systems. And she was looking for student volunteers to help her in summer research. And I'm like, I'll do it. And it wasn't because of GPR. It was just because I was so enamored with her, right? And there's no secret. I've told her this. It's like 35 years later. It doesn't matter. But and it just spurred my interest. And I looked at this and go, wow, this is the future in terms of everything in geophysics has been done. And I am not interested in doing things that everybody else is doing. I really like taking the stuff that nobody else is doing and running with that. And here's a new technology that wasn't oil and gas related, but I could see potential. I could see there was niche market and very few people were doing it. So that's how it started.
Cool. That's really cool. So where, how long did that journey go? I mean, that was your undergrad? Right? You said that you were like 1920?
Literally my first year of my undergrad. Yeah, like late 1980s. That's right. Before you guys were born, probably.
No, it is so not before we were born.
Jeez. So what you're saying is if you don't know what to do in college, then find someone, a cute professor, and see what they're interested in, and then follow that.
Pretty much, because yeah. All I was trying to do is impress her, right? And I'm still trying to impress her.
So this was truly like the very beginning of your undergrad that you figured out in that first year what you wanted to be spending your career in.
Yeah, oh, very.
And then it actually happened. On. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, right. Like I am drawn to things and ideas that people aren't, right? So if everybody is playing hockey in Canada as a kid, that's the last thing I want to do, because how could I ever become good at it? Because A, I suck, and B, there's 1,000 other kids on my block that do the same thing. Why don't I find a sport that nobody else is doing, and I could do really well in that? Like
curling.
International level stair climbing. And believe it or not, I was on the national team for stair climbing. I went around the world. You know how easy it is to get on the national team when it's stair climbing? But you get to go all over the world doing that, right? And that's the same philosophy for GPR at the time. Nobody was doing it. And the people who were using it for archaeology, boring, and finding pipes in the ground, really boring. I looked at it and went, there's got to be something else we can do with this, right? And so I, you know, I'm an only child, and I'm of Asian parenting, right? So I can basically get away with anything I want. So I went to my mother in like 1990, and I said, Mom, I need to borrow $20,000, which is a hell of a lot of money back then, right? It still is. I want to buy a GPR system. I want to start a business around GPR. And, anyway, I'm an only child, so I got $20,000, right? It's like an early inheritance. And I went and bought one of the first, you know, sensors and software system that was kind of analog, but it worked. And started International Ground Radar, and it wasn't international at the time. I didn't have any projects for it, but just one thing led to another, and it turned into within 3 years I was working in Ecuador of all places, right? So it just kind of went from there, and I was really targeting deeper applications.
So were you from the very get-go? You were using a very low frequency antenna. So I mean, for the geeks out there, the GPR geeks out there, what kind of frequency range were you focusing on in the very beginning?
Right. So there was no choice, right? Back in the early 90s, there wasn't any system available that went above 200 megahertz. So if you were doing utilities detection, you were using two sticks of plastic that had some dipole antennas unshielded and moving it around trying to find pipes. That's all we had. So when we say low frequency, for me at the time, it was like 150 or 25 megahertz. And that's what people weren't doing. And that's what attracted me to it, right? I don't like competition. So I saw this opportunity and it just took off because there was this niche market. And I'll tell you the story. So it was just serendipitous, right? What happened was I went and bought this system without any idea what the heck I was doing. How am I going to start this business? And I got a bit of work through the university that people needed some alluvial mapping of old gold channels in the Yukon. But what happened at the same time that summer was, now the province over for me is called Alberta, and Alberta has Canada's oil and gas reserves, right? And they are distributed up and down the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And all of those reserves get exploited and shipped by pipeline to central processing facilities. And those pipelines cross rivers and streams. Well, how do you do that? Well, in the old days, what they used to do is essentially lay a line of explosives across the river, blow up a trench, roll the pipe into it, cover it up, Bob's your uncle. And around that time, the environment minister said, no, you can't do that. It's killing fish, explosives in river bad. Okay, oh. Well, how do we build a trench? The only way to do that is something called horizontal directional drilling, where you take, the drill and you drive under the river and back up. The problem is if you hit sediment in the middle of the river, you lose the hole. How do you solve that? Aha, we'll use seismic. Oh, wait a minute. Seismic uses explosives. Shit, what are we gonna do? Hey, why don't we use GPR? Well, who has a deep enough GPR? It just so happens that's literally when I bought this GPR. I modified it and somebody called me up and said, hey, do you want to do this? And I said, no, because I can't swim and I don't want to be on a river in Alberta. Thank you very much. So they convinced me to put a life jacket on and row a canoe across the river with these two bloody things with Home Depot, PVC pipes. It looked hilarious. It looks straight out of Gilligan's Island. But lo and behold, the data was amazing. You could totally see all the sediments. And I'm going, holy crap, this no GPS, no nothing. We had no idea where the heck we were on the river, but at least you could see something, right? And a business was built around it. And people were paying $10,000 a river. And I could knock off like two or three rivers in a week, easy, in the early 90s while still doing my undergrad. And pretty soon, Occidental Petroleum from Quito, Ecuador calls up and says, hey, our Calgary office says you're doing some work up there. You got to come down here and do this huge river. I'm like, okay, so you make your own antenna and go down to Ecuador and you do this crazy survey in the early 90s across a tributary to the Amazon, right, with freaking anaconda in it. It was amazing. And it just grew from there. And it's still growing.
So for someone that's young, that's trying to figure out what they're doing, how did you overcome, did you have any fear with starting this up, with going down to Ecuador, you said you don't want to swim, but how was that for you? Was it your personality that you just wanted to, it was exciting for you, or was it a scary at all for you?
I think in terms of what I tell young people coming into an industry like this, is that there are two paths, right? And it is personality driven. Either you do the safe thing, which is go learn how to use GPR and EML locators and go start a company or join a company that does utilities detection. And guess what? You'll make good money and you'll have job security for a long time, right? I can't guarantee you're going to be super happy and fulfilled, but whatever your goal in life is, right? On the other hand, if you want something really neat and to be challenged every day, then you get into something that uses those magic words called specialized expertise, right? And that's what I really try to stick to all my life, is try to be the specialist in whatever it is. It could be basket weaving. It doesn't matter. But somewhere, somebody in the world needs your specific skill set.
That's a great advice.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal attitude. So, what are the barriers that came up? Because I mean, with us starting this company, there have been so many barriers that came up that I just had no idea were even going to be a thing. Least of all, the all the problems that we have, or not problems, but all the regulations that we have, like in California, that are just very specialized to this state. So I'm curious what kind of hurdles that you came up against early on in your company, early on in your education, that were totally unforeseen, that we maybe take for granted today.
You know, so much of the pushback I felt from peers and even, you know, professors in the academic world was around the opposite of specialized expertise, because there's so much risk involved in that. And their driving, you know, message was always, you need to have more broad skill set because you can't make money just doing radar. And this is 30 years ago, right? And I kind of went, I bet you I can. I bet you I can. And I, you know, I've never understood the concept of having a job. I've never actually had a job in my life, quite honestly. I worked in a bike store as a teenager, and that was the last job I've had as such. So I didn't get that memo, right? And I knew I wanted to do something for myself. So I just kind of went into it and went, well, let's roll the dice. And if it all falls apart, I do have a degree in geophysics. I can go join a company if it all falls apart. And I've still never paid my mother back that $20,000, you know.
Yeah. What about the FCC? You know, there's the FCC in the U.S. What's the Canadian?
It's called Industry Canada, and the relevant regulation is RSS 220. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, sadly, we tend to somewhat follow the American lead when it comes to RF regulations. So what happened was in the mid-90s, early 90s, there were a couple of events that we won't get into, but there was some concern from the FAA, specifically around airports, for example, as well as the FCC, that GPR, because by its nature, see, if I had a police radar, like a radar gun, and I'm catching you for speeding, for example, my radar gun is very narrow band. That means I'm transmitting and receiving in a very specific set of frequencies. The same thing with FM radio, or even, you know, I do a lot of TV reality show stuff, and the audio guys there, they actually own certain frequency numbers, right? So they will have a license to operate in California at 415.953 megahertz. That's fine. So it becomes the RF spectrum in the United States almost becomes a little bit of a property situation where I, as a taxi company, you know, I might own a certain band. The problem with GPR is by its very nature and definition, it is extremely broadband. So Forrest, Arian, when you use a 500 megahertz antenna, you're actually transmitting from about 200 up to 750, 800 megahertz. Everything. You are just shouting out to the world, even with your shielded antennas.
Right. It's a whole bell curve thing. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Right. So you are, in theory, then potentially interfering with very important communication, be it FAA related stuff around an airport. But in also theory, you could be infringing in somebody else's property rights, right? Like, you don't know if you are stepping on somebody who owns a bandwidth at a specific frequency. So there were a few incidents that occurred in the 90s, and the FAA lobbied the FCC, and the FCC in the United States says, okay, no radar at all, banned. We're banning radar, basically, right? Wow. And their industry went, wow, what the heck? Whoa, hold on, hold your horses here, right? And specifically, MALA for a little bit, but certainly Sensors and Software and GSSI spent probably millions of dollars, because this is their livelihoods, right? Millions of dollars to lobby and hire lobbyists for the FCC to say, well, wait a minute, I understand your concerns, but let us have a certain part of the market, right? So the rules are that you, in the United States, you have to use shielded antennas, you have to have a low power, and it has to be within 1 or 3 feet of the ground surface. So we operate under these conditions. So they gave us kind of a pass and said, yeah, you can do this within certain limitations. And the industry went, thank you very much. At least we can keep going.
So has that been kind of a shut case now? I mean, since that happened, has this been revisited? Have there been threats from the FCC or FAA like, hey, maybe we should revisit this?
Yeah, it's sort of like, You know, it's sort of a don't ask, don't tell sort of thing, it seems, right? So it hasn't really been revisited extensively, but we're running some risks right now. So, you know, in the last, thankfully they've gone away, but in the last 5 to 7 years, there's been Eastern European companies that have tried to market very deep penetrating radar with megawatt transmitters, which are thousands of times outside of FCC limits. Now, their argument is, oh, well, you know, who's going to ever know? Yeah, but, you know, that's not how you skirt around a law. The other risk is this huge interest in drone geophysics and specifically carrying a radar system on a drone. And great, that sounds super cool. It sounds super sexy. I can do everything without touching the ground. Heck, I can do it from my car, right? Well, there's a couple problems with that. Firstly, the FCC regulations clearly state it's within 1 meter of the ground surface, right? So that's a problem, unless you fly your drone really close. And number two, it doesn't work very well in the first place. So, you know, we have physics issues and we have legal issues around that. But what I hate seeing are people on LinkedIn showing pictures of GPRs well over a meter off the ground and advertising it, right? It's like saying, oh, hey, look at my cool rocket launch. Well, that's probably legal in the States for you guys, but it would be like me in Canada saying I have a handgun. Look at this.
Yeah, we have three rocket launchers. So
exactly. Yeah. That's a Walmart purchase for you guys.
It is. Well, it's not a Walmart. I mean, we're in Southern California. That's a corner of the, you know,
down on that's
the
right.
Yeah, a little more black market here.
Yeah, we get that down on the
corner. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. No serial numbers, but yeah, we can get on the corner.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting because, I mean, that's something that I hear about with some regularity, this concern about the FCC, the FAA, and interfering with their communications and, you know, doing that in a way that draws attention and almost people almost being kind of cavalier about doing this. And, you know, I have a business that relies very heavily on the use of ground penetrating radar. So I'm very inclined to not, run amiss of these regulations in the US. And it's the same. So this is the US and Canada, but you work all over. All over the world. It's similar in the EU?
It is very, very similar. It's called ETSI in the EU, and then there's a similar one within the United Kingdom. So they're all very, very similar worded. So certainly, even in Europe, you know, having a drone GPR over 1 meter is a big no-no. I would like to think that ETSI and the Europeans are a little bit more vigilant about policing that than we are here in North America. That's my feeling of it. But I don't know of anyone who's been actually, you know, issued a fine or received any sort of punitive action for breaking or circumventing the laws. But I wouldn't want to be the first one, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, but what you're also saying is that it's not only a legal issue, but there's... But from a physics standpoint, you have a huge attenuation of the electromagnetic pulse into and then returning from the ground.
Here, yeah, for someone exactly that doesn't know
and
much,
this is the annoying part, right? And
we're getting a little deep, Arian. I'm sorry. Okay,
for someone that doesn't know much yet? About, because we're talking to people in broadly in the construction industry here. Someone doesn't know much about GPR here. What is attenuation? What are some of these terms here that you're using?
So what? I mean, it's very simple, right? You have a pulse of radio energy, some of which goes into the ground, some of which goes into the air. That energy goes into the ground and gets absorbed at various degrees depending on the material you're in. So in a very wet environment, for example, it gets absorbed easier. And that means you don't get the same penetration as in a dry concrete, for example. And the amount of clarity you see is based on how good the material is at transmitting radio energy, essentially. So the same system that might see only 1 meter deep or 3 feet in your case deep in a really good environment might only see 1 foot deep in a bad environment. Okay, So that's how attenuation works, and that's generally how radar works. The problem is we say, okay, but you're saying I have to drag this device with my hand over the ground or over a concrete slab. That sounds really hard. Why can't I just mount it on a drone or some sort of UAV and do it off the ground? And then the drone can do all the work for me, right? And that's where it all falls apart, because when the energy enters the air, it spreads out. It's like taking a mag light and opening up the aperture a great amount. In fact, three times more. So now we have a larger surface area that's being illuminated by the radar energy. And just like a mag light, if you open it up too far, you can't see anything. It just spreads the energy out too far, right? We don't want that. That's fine for some applications with a mag light, but for radar, we want to try and focus that energy because we want to get that into the ground. So what happens when you raise the antenna off the ground is that you lose penetration, not just a little bit, but you lose up to like 80% of penetration. So you have to ask yourself, why the heck would I possibly want to do that? Well, an example would be that I work with militaries around the world to develop radars for unexploded ordnance, landmine detection, right? And we know that we can get some data from a drone flying over a field that has landmines, but the data sucks. It sucks compared to dragging an actual radar on the ground. It has far less penetration. You can barely see anything. But from a planning and logistics standpoint, well, what are you going to do? Put a soldier on the ground dragging a radar and blow him up? That's not an option. So in that case, some data is better than no data. So there are applications, but for utilities detection, man, unless you're in Chernobyl and you just can't put boots on the ground, you're always going to get better data by actually surveying the ground.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
That's really interesting. But this is, so this has really just been regulated in basically North America, UK, Europe. Is this something that's regulated more in, or much in Australia at all? Is it very similar verbiage in regulations there?
Yes and no. There are some specific RF regulations in Australia. It is certainly not enforced, and it is up to the licensee. So if you are operating at a certain frequency and you feel that there's interference, then you can contact the regulatory authority to investigate. But I've never heard of that happening, right?
Even if somebody did, even if that was someone went through the trouble of contacting the government to investigate this, I mean, the guy who was using an unshielded antenna nearby, he's long gone. You know, he was there for a few hours or a day or two, and then he's out of there. So you had that interference for a time, and then it's gone, and there's no catching. So it's always seemed to me like this is one of those laws that's nearly impossible to enforce, but it's there so that if somebody did want to try to enforce it, they could. But it's nearly impossible to really ever catch somebody doing this. This isn't like speeding or something.
That's exactly right. So imagine, you know, if you had an unshielded antenna and you were using it in a rural environment, even in the United States, yes, of course it's illegal. In terms of impact to those who could be affected, there's none. I mean, unless you happen to have a ham radio, you know, station next door or some secret government listening facility underground that you happen to be nearby. But it would be absolutely foolish and extremely unprofessional for you to take that and do it outside LAX or JFK Airport, right? Because you know that it's a sensitive site. Or, for example, you wouldn't do that near a petrochemical facility because they have lots of fire eyes or other fire detection systems that could be triggered by, errant RF interference. So you have to be aware of where you're doing that. And of course, the government, you know, they're not in the business of trusting their citizens to do things responsibly, except in the case of guns, in your case. so they regulate, say, no, you just can't do it in the United States.
Yeah. So could you, could you speak to that a little bit, your feelings concerning the way that things are going in the industry in terms of responsibility, taking responsibility for the way that we're using ground penetrating radar. I mean, North America, everywhere else, but just your feelings on that. Yeah. You have a long experience history, you have a deep education, and you have expansive experience all over the world. What would you say is really concerning you about the way that ground penetrating radar is used or marketed today?
Yeah, you know what? What I'm about to say hasn't changed for 30 years. Every few years, somebody comes along with what they think is a new idea. And when you have something new, you go, wow, I'm going to really promote this because I'm the only one who has this. And this is going to make me millions of dollars. And my God, this is going to change the industry. You know, back in the 90s, there was a company in California that created a step frequency radar system with a very cool spiral antenna, right? So it had multiple polarizations and stuff. And they were showing some really amazing imagery of a pipe joint where you could actually see individual bolts on that joint. And it was this kind of concept. They said, oh, this was processed by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. JPL did this, and it's amazing using our radar. And, you know, anybody who had used radar at the time went, really? Really? Was this done in a sandbox in a lab, or this is a real pipe joint? Because really? How does this work? And of course, they kind of fall by the wayside. But at the time, it generated a lot of interest, right? And this is going to be revolutionary. And then, you know, a few years later, then we have other people coming along. There's always something new. You know, about 5 years ago, there was a company in Europe saying, we have a step frequency radar. It's going to change the world. It does all these frequencies. With one radar, we can go from 40 megahertz up to 3 gigahertz. It's like, no, it doesn't. Absolutely not. You know, is it absolutely a lie? No, it's borderline, though, because you still have to put your energy into an antenna, and the antenna only has a certain bandwidth, right? So I could transmit out whatever I want, but it still has to go through a speaker, and my speaker can only speak at a certain, you know, from low frequency to high frequency. So am I really transmitting? No, I'm not. And you know what? If we could have done that, we would have done that 20 years ago. There's a reason why every other radar company uses impulse, you know, concepts. So exciting, but it's just marketing hype. And now the latest is drone. You know, we can do everything from a drone. And you know, I have to walk a fine line there because I know the guys who are, you know, promoting the drone GPRs, and they just, you know, they have a technology that they're trying to promote as much as possible. But what we don't mention are, you know, the physics behind it that says, yeah, it works, but not nearly as well as something else. So it's like saying, I have a sports car, right? And I can take it anywhere. I literally can take it anywhere. I can take it through the Mojave Desert. And you kind of go, well, you could, but it's probably not the best tool to take through the Mojave Desert, right? But in theory, you could, I suppose. It's the same concept. Sure, you can do everything from a drone, but it's not the smartest way to do it. You're not going to get any performance out of it. So it's so much around marketing hype. And what I fear is as this industry is growing almost exponentially, we have new players coming to the market that are easily sold on this sexy marketing and ease of use, and it becomes all about sexiness now, right? There's the physics and the science is out the window. Now it's about who has a cooler video, or who does a better job at promoting their product on LinkedIn. Nothing to do with science at all or performance. And I guess that's the way an industry progresses, isn't it?
I guess so. I suppose that's, I mean, it could be said about anything, about the personal computer, about tablets, smartphones, about anything.
Well, yes and no. So, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but let's say this. Yeah. Okay, let's give you an analogy. Toyota comes out with a new ad that they publish on TV, on the internet, and they say, we've got a new RAV4 that goes 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. Okay, that's their claim, right? Now, anyone who knows anything about cars or even doesn't know about cars is going to go, bullshit, no way, that's not possible with an internal combustion engine. It just can't happen, right? And they would be ridiculed in the press. There's a million magazines. There's a million motorheads out there that would just start laughing at this going, is this an April Fool's joke? Why? Because people understand how the gas engine works, right? They understand how cars work. But I could come up with a new radar company that says, I am going to combine all these sensors. I'm going to fly it from a satellite. What the hell? Let's make it a satellite. And I can see all the pipes in California all at once. And you might go, oh, really? That's pretty amazing, right? Well, not you specifically, but somebody could, because there's not that base level knowledge around how it works. It's a black box. A car, we know when you're lying. I don't even know cars, but I know that's not possible with a RAV4, right? So I'd call it out right away. With a GPR, most people would go, oh, well, shit, maybe it can do that.
Right. Yeah, so there's just not that base understanding, because cars are a lot more, I don't want to say simple, but a lot more people understand cars than there are people who understand GPR. Kids
understand how a car should work. So if you're going to make a crazy claim by Toyota, you'd have to have a lot of evidence to back it up.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. That is a little different about our industry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and well, so...
Jan, what's exciting you about your future here with what you're working on?
Oh, man, there's... You know, as my career has progressed, I used to do a lot of field work myself and actually drag systems through tropical jungles. I've been in civil wars. I've been shot at a number of times. And that was all exciting. And now I have a daughter, so I have some responsibility. I'm told that I can't do crazy crap, you know, stuff like that.
Sorry,
so now it's more sitting at a desk. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now it's sitting at a desk and you know, developing custom systems. And some of the stuff I do is pretty neat. You know, it's stuff that you never would have thought that radar is applicable to. And it's, you know, somebody somewhere has a problem. And sometimes radar, the concept of GPR, can help. Be it counting fish going up a stream during spawning season to finding liquefaction in a bulk ore carrier out at sea. Weird, weird applications that are all potentially radar related. And now I'm doing a lot of reality TV shows, and each of those have their own technical challenges to come up with radars that fit in small holes or to find, you know, various things. So that's kind of neat as well.
That's cool. What can you tell us, or can you tell us anything about space and ground penetrating radar?
Wow. Well, there's a lot. This is, you know, literally the next frontier, because what people don't realize right now, amidst COVID and U.S. elections and all the other things that are going on in the world, nobody's looking up. And what's amazing is, you know, everything related to the Artemis mission and what's going on with the international effort on the lunar surface, particularly in the South Pole, right? You know, India just landed a rover there. They're wandering around taking beautiful pictures and have lots of cool sensors on board. Very, very impressive. And what does that say to the history of lunar exploration? And the Indians were able to pull this off in spectacular fashion at a fraction of the cost of a typical Hollywood movie, right? Which essentially democratizes the ability to explore the lunar surface. And why is that important? Because, you know, as we move towards a multiplanetary species and probably, you know, colonize Mars at some point, we know that we can't launch from Earth. We just don't have the capacity to do that because of our gravity. The easiest way to do that would be as using a launching pad on the moon, for example, right? So that involves, this is the Moon to Mars mission, and that involves building a lunar base of some sort, be it manned or roboticized, on the moon. And how do we do that? Well, we need certain resources. One of the big ones is H2O. We need water, and we know that there is water contained on the South Pole. Well, how do we quantify that water? Well, it turns out that radar works really well at mapping ice, right? Wow, that's cool. And radar is something that can be just literally dragged behind a rover. So I'm actually developing a couple different rover-based radar systems for that application. But there's another issue on the moon, and that is, if we have people up there, well, where the heck are they going to live? You can't just build a structure. The easiest thing to do is to use something that's already present, and that would be a basaltic lava tube, for example, that would maybe be just under the surface, so a large tunnel, and inhabit that and use that as your base. Well, how do you find where those are? Turns out the lunar surface is amazing for penetration of radar energy. Again, a low-frequency radar dragged by a rover back and forth. We will be able to map out where there are large void spaces. And then some lunar engineer, which is, you know, a new profession that your kids will be doing, will come up with a way of inhabiting that that void space. So there's a huge application for GPR, not only on the lunar surface, but also on Mars. You know, once we get to Mars, there's an entire field of astrophysics and astronomy called extraplanetary archaeology, believe it or not, right? And the concept there is to say, okay, there's no little green men on Mars, fine, at least we don't know of any. But that doesn't mean that a billion years ago there wasn't somebody there, or there wasn't a civilization, there wasn't something there. And how would we look for them? Well, would we not use an analogy to terrestrial archaeology? And what do we use for terrestrial archaeology that works really well is GPR. So, you know, there's a team that actually is testing out different GPR systems, not necessarily for geology, but potentially for archaeology on Mars to see if there was any evidence of a previous thing.
That's amazing. So, Jan, yeah, so just to sum up, you're using GPR to find little green men on Mars.
That's exactly right. Well, not only to find them, but to say hello to them as well.
Yeah, say
right?
hello.
See if we can communicate. Yeah,
exactly. That's amazing. Right. Okay, well, we should probably end on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Jan, we want to have you on as a guest again. It's fun, so interesting talking with you, but really, really appreciate your time here today. Yeah, I wanted to ask if there are any closing thoughts that you had for our audience here who are interested in what you do, interested in how to find a path that is similar to yours in terms of specialization. Is there one thing or that you did do or one thing you made sure to avoid to get you to this point?
You know, it's getting harder to do because there's more players in the field, right? It's like, yeah, I could do well at stair climbing only because there was only a couple hundred people in the world doing it. But now there's like, you know, 10,000 GPR operators. So it's hard to find that specialized niche market. So, you know, I look at the GPR industry and I think there's still so much opportunity that is not being tapped. There's a core group that provides services and there's some big companies around that. And they've set a price point for their services that isn't necessarily commensurate with the amount of service providers out there. So I think there's going to be a little bit of a change in the pricing structure of GPR services coming up. And there's absolutely no reason why somebody new to the industry can't find a niche for themselves, either by a different pricing model, potentially, or by using newer equipment, right? So many of the older companies have single channel radars and are slow to adopt the future, which is obviously the multi-channels, right? The big array systems. And you, Forrest, you've probably done some multi-channel array surveys, and it's not about spray painting on the ground, right? Let's get away from that. Spray painting was caveman sort of thing. And we are now in 2023. It is so important to be able to capture that data and produce a quality map. And that's how you can separate yourself and differentiate yourself from some of these smaller, lower level companies.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I think that's great. Jan, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate you taking the time, and it's always entertaining and informative to have discussions with you. So thanks very much. Right, we appreciate your time today.
Yeah,
hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, and thanks for all our listeners. Please remember to like and subscribe so that we can get other great guests on like Jan in the future. And Jan, where can people find you if they're interested in learning a little bit more about you? Do you have websites or?
Yeah, so there is my OnlyFans account.
Like OnlyFans, yeah. That's where you and I met. That's where I first met. Yep.
Sorry, Aaron. I think the world's professional marketplace right now is LinkedIn. So I think LinkedIn is probably the easiest. I'm sure on your videos you can put my email address, whatever. I'm happy to talk to people, happy to give advice. I'm always here to talk to.
Yeah, and we'll put your cell phone number out there too, so we'll make sure everybody knows how to get to you. Yep. Okay, great.
Nice.
Thanks, Jan.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
All right, see ya. Thank you.